This is Audible.
Harper Audio presents The Wicked City by Beatrice Williams, performed by Julie McKay and Dara Rosenberg.
New York City, 1998. Ella visited the laundry room for the first time at 6:30 on a Saturday morning at the beginning of March. Not that the timing really mattered, she decided later, when her life had taken on its new, extraordinary dimensions and she'd begun to consider the uncanny moment of that beginning. Certain things, let's call them that, certain things had a way of tracking you down and finding you, even when you thought you were just going to wash some clothes in a Greenwich Village basement. She'd moved into the building a week ago, and the hamper in the corner bathroom seemed pitifully empty without all the bulk of Patrick's things. Still, it was time. Standards must be upheld. You couldn't keep laundry in a hamper for more than a week, whatever catastrophe had interrupted your life. Too seedy. Too regressive. Anyway, Ella's mother was bound to call her up soon for the morning welfare check, and she would surely ask whether Ella had done her laundry yet. And Ella wanted to be able to say yes without lying. A woman could smoke out a lie like a pair of shoes on sale at Bergdorf's. She'd already gone out for a run in the damp charcoal streets, but she hadn't showered yet. Terrific thing about insomnia. You could do things like go running and do your laundry without having to confront your fellow tenants in a state of squalor. As she descended the cold stairwell to the basement, she realized that its strange odor was actually the fug of her own sweat. Salt and skin not yet turning to stink. Her hair, badly in need of washing, whirled in a greasy knot at the back of her head, held from collapse by a denim scrunchie that had not been fashionable even during the heyday of scrunchies. Loose gray sweatpants, looser gray t-shirt emblazoned with her college logo. She peeled off her running clothes to fill out the wash load. And on her feet, the shearling L.L. Bean slippers Patrick always hated, because they were crummy and smelled like camping. Teeth, furry, no bra. She remembered all these details because of what occurred inside that laundry room the first time she entered. 6:30 in the morning, the first Saturday of March. A starter marriage, her mother called it. Ella had never heard the term before.
"There was an article in the style section just a month or two ago," Mama said. "It made me think of you."
"But we only split up the week before last," Ella said, staring at the cluster of U-Haul boxes in the center of her new bedroom.
"I never trusted him."
"You could have fooled me." Mama leaned back against a stack of towels and made one of those gestures with her right hand, like she was flicking out ash from a cigarette that no longer existed. An amputee with a phantom limb.
"Oh, I liked him well enough. What wasn't to like? I just didn't trust him."
"I didn't realize there was a difference."
"Well, there is. Anyway, it seems the term was coined by a fellow named Douglas. Douglas something or other, in some sort of novel he wrote about your generation."
"Douglas Copeland?"
"Yes, Copeland. Douglas Copeland. Have you read it?"
"Generation X, or else Shampoo Planet?"
"No, the first one."
"Read them both in grad school, but I don't remember anything about starter marriages."
"It was in a footnote, apparently. I expect you missed it. You're all in such a rush, your generation. You miss the details.
I might have read it and just forgotten.
You should take your time. The footnotes are the best part.
Ella rose from the bed and picked up the X-Acto knife from the clutter on her chest of drawers. Her mother had a way of saying everything like a double entendre. The suggestive throatiness of the take your time and footnotes. What were footnotes in her mother's secret vocabulary? Better not to know. For one thing, there was Daddy.
Starter marriage, Mama? You were saying?
A first marriage made for the wrong reasons or because you didn't have enough experience to judge the merchandise. Like a starter home or a starter car. You trade up.
You and Daddy didn't have to trade up.
We were lucky. I was lucky. The point is, it's nothing to be ashamed of. As long as you haven't got kids, you just move on. Move on, move up.
The X-Acto knife had one of those retractable blades, and Ella couldn't seem to make it work. The edge came out halfway and stuck.
Look, could we not talk about moving on for another week or so? I haven't even talked to a lawyer yet.
Why not? I gave you the number.
And the fact that you have a divorce lawyer on speed dial kind of stresses me out, by the way.
He's not on speed dial, and he's not a divorce lawyer. He's a colleague of your father's. He can give you advice, that's all.
Ella's mother uncrossed her legs and rose from the bed so gracefully she might have been Odette. Or Odile.
God knows you won't take it from me.
That's not true.
Isn't it? What about your wedding dress?
That was 4 years ago.
And was I right?
Ella banged the bottom of the X-Acto knife on the toaster oven.
You were right about the dress, but you might have warned me about the groom.
Oh, darling.
Mama plucked the knife from her fingers, flicked out the blade with a single nudge of her thumb, and sliced delicately along the seam of a box labeled Sweaters, Cashmere.
You wouldn't have listened to that either. You were in love.
In love.
Ella could still remember what it felt like. Falling in love. Being in love. She remembered it as a certain moment. The first really warm day of that year, a month or two after she met Patrick, when he was away on a business trip in Europe and she was alone for the first Saturday in weeks. She'd put on her favorite cotton sundress, which had lain squashed in her drawer since October and reminded her instantly of Granny's house on Cumberland Island. The smell of summer. She'd gone outside into the innocent sunshine, bought an iced coffee, and walked by herself in Central Park, entering near the Museum of Natural History and making her way southeast without any particular goal. As she strolled past the entwined couples drowsing in the sheep meadow, she'd gazed at them, for the first time in benevolence instead of envy. She thought, actually spoke inside her head in conscious words that she still recalled exactly. I'm so happy. It's the end of May, and I'm in love, and the whole summer lies before us. An immaculate joy had quickened her feet along the asphalt paths, the conviction that the world was beautiful. She'd even sung under her breath a few bars of that song, "And I Think to Myself, What a Wonderful World," to which she ended up dancing with her father at her wedding 2 years later, and that the rest of her life was just falling into its ordained pattern before her. The life she was meant to live, unfolding itself at last. Courtship, marriage, apartment, exotic, self-indulgent vacations, then kids, house in Connecticut, school runs and mom coffees. Less exotic, more wholesome vacations. Which shade of white to paint the trim in the dining room? Later that day, she had dinner with her sister and spilled out every detail, every silvery moonbeam over pasta and red wine at Isabella's. And not once, that entire love-struck Saturday, did she suspect that Patrick was doing anything other than working. Working really hard throughout his Saturday in Frankfurt. Thinking of her the whole time. Not once did the possibility of disloyalty enter her head. They were in love. Hadn't he told her so before he left on Tuesday? In between kisses, naked in bed, warm and secure. "I finally found you," he said, his actual words while he held her face in his hands. What could be more certain than that? Now, she had to go back and recall all those old business trips, every late night at work, every client dinner, and wonder which ones he was lying about. A painfully detailed revision of history and memory. And that was the worst part, because she could still remember how wonderful it was to be in love with him. But that was 6 years ago. Now, she had this too light basket of laundry and this dark, chilly stairwell on Christopher Street painted in gray and moist against her skin. Only blocks away from the sleek Soho loft conversion she had shared with Patrick, which had its own washer and dryer and required no stair climbing of any kind, except on the row of stairmasters in the residence gym, eternally occupied, unlike the building stairwells, because you weren't climbing those steps to go anywhere. My God, of course not. Just to stay skinny. Sorry, to keep fit. Of course, in the cold light of reason, Ella should have been the one to kick Patrick out. Damn it! He should have been the one cramming his belongings into a studio apartment in the village. "It's charming," Mama said last Sunday, picking her way between the boxes to peer out the window into the asphalt garden out back. While Ella, crowned by a nimbus of moral superiority, enthroned herself on one of the egg chairs inside the 2,000-square-foot loft on Prince Street. He should have been the one bumping a laundry basket into a damp basement in search of a rumored laundry room, while she flicked her sweaty running clothes into the washing machine off the granite kitchen and sipped an espresso from the DeLonghi. Not that Patrick would ever do his own laundry, even if he knew how. In his bachelor days, he sent it out for wash and fold. He should have been spending his weekend unpacking boxes and contemplating the miniature kitchen in the corner. The way you had to step around the toilet to exit the shower. The way you had to open said shower door and prop your foot on said toilet in order to shave your legs. Not that Patrick shaved his legs, either. At least, not since his brief but expensive flirtation with a carbon-framed racing bicycle. But she'd been too shocked and angry to consider her rights as the wronged wife. Hadn't she? No. Wait. That wasn't right. Shocked and angry? Not visceral enough. She'd felt as if a loud steam whistle were blowing inside her skull, as if her insides were melting, as if her legs and arms had no nerves. And how could you think straight when your body was in such disarray? So, instead of waiting to confront Patrick, send Patrick to the doghouse as he deserved, she'd fled into the bedroom, trying not to look at the bed itself, and packed a few things into a gym bag and rushed to Aunt Viv and Uncle Paul's apartment in Gramercy. Stammered an explanation she didn't fully comprehend herself. Spent the next week in their guest room, searching the classifieds for no-fee apartments and fending off her friend's sympathy and her parents' advice. Fending off the manic trill of her cell phone every few hours, which she refused to answer. And now, here she stood, instead of Patrick, in a Christopher Street basement before a metal door labeled laundry at 6:30 in the morning, balancing the basket on her hip while she fumbled with the door handle, thinking, at least I've got the jump on everyone else, washing clothes this early on a Manhattan Saturday morning, the one time when the damn city actually does sleep. But as the door cracked open, and Ella stuck in her shameful, shearling-lined foot to push it out the rest of the way, a wondrous and unexpected noise met her ears. The sound of four industrial washing machines and two industrial dryers, all churning in furious, metallic frenzy. Not only that, each machine bore a basket of laundry on top, claiming dibs, waiting to pounce at the end of the cycle. Ella's eyes found the clock on the wall, just to make sure that she hadn't somehow missed daylight savings time. Nope. 6:34. She let the basket slide down to the concrete floor, put her hands on her hips. "What the hell?" she wailed. "Who are you people?"
"Oh, hello,"
said a male voice behind her, appallingly sunny.
"You must be the new one."
Ella turned so quickly she kicked over the basket. Jog bra spilled out. Sweaty running shirt. 7 days' worth of lace panties in various rainbow hues. Patrick scorned boring underwear. She bent down and scooped desperately. "Yes, I am. 4D. Moved in last weekend." A pair of legs strolled into view, clad in blue jeans and a battered pair of nylon Jesus sandals.
"Jeez, I'm sorry. Didn't mean to startle you. Let me..."
"No, I've got it." Ella scooped the last article back in the basket, tried to find something innocuous to go on top. Something without lace. Something that wasn't hot pink. Something that didn't smell. She straightened at last and looked up. "I just wasn't expecting. The man laughed at her dangling sentence, as if he had no idea what had scattered her train of thought. No idea at all that he was young and dark-haired and wore a force field of tousled happiness that fried away the dampness in the basement air.
"Not expecting all the washing machines full at this hour of the morning? Sorry about that, too. Just one of the quirks about life inside 11 Christopher. I'm Hector, by the way. Top floor."
He held out his hand. Ella transferred the basket to her opposite hip and grasped his palm. Firm. Steady. Brief. "Hector?" she said.
"My mom's a classics professor." "Was."
"She's retired."
"No. Died a few years ago. Breast cancer."
"Oh, my God, I'm so sorry."
"Me too."
He turned away and moved to the second washing machine, which had just finished a thunderous spin cycle and now sat in stupor.
"Tell you what, special deal for the newbie. You jump the queue and take over my machine, and I didn't see a thing."
"That would be so unscrupulous. What if I get caught?" Hector tossed her a luminous grin.
"In that case, I guess I'd just take the blame. Pull rank. I have seniority around here. Well, except Mrs. McDonald on the ground floor. She's been here since the Second World War. Gets an automatic laundry pass."
"Sounds like you all know each other."
"We are kind of a tight crew, you might say."
He moved away with his basket of wet clothes.
"All yours, 4D."
"Thanks so much. I really appreciate it."
"So, that was your cue, by the way."
"My cue?"
"You're supposed to tell me your name, unless it really is 4D.
"Oh, sorry. I'm a little slow on weekends. It's Ella. Ella Gilbert."
"Nice to meet you, Ella Gilbert. Welcome to the neighborhood."
He set his palms on the edge of the folding table along the opposite wall and hoisted himself up.
Don't mind me. Just waiting for that dryer to finish up.
Ella looked at the two machines, clunking in hypnotic circles. So, what if the owner doesn't turn up in time? Is there a protocol?
Oh, you know, we just take the load out and fold it.
No, seriously.
Seriously?
We? As in the other tenants, you fold each other's laundry around here?
Like I said, tight crew.
I guess so.
Once you get to know everyone, I mean.
To this, Ella made a non-committal, huh. Get to know everyone. What was this, college? And studied the instructions on the lid of the washer. Realized she was supposed to add the soap first. Started to unload.
What's up? Something wrong with the washer?
Hector asked. Nothing, just... I guess you add the soap first on this model.
Ella, I hate to have to break this to you, but it really doesn't matter. Soap first or soap after? Unless there's a soap drawer, I guess, which there isn't. Pretty basic machine.
Ella stopped with her hand on a t-shirt. But it says...
So break the rules. It's okay. What's the worst that could happen?
I don't know. The whole laundry room floods with soap? Hector laughs.
You are awesome. You know that? Go ahead. I dare you. Be bad.
Ella overturned the basket into the drum, added half a cup of liquid Tide, and slammed the lid. There. Are you happy?
I am. Felt good, didn't it?
Maybe. She turned and leaned her bottom against the washer, an act of supreme courage because it brought her back in direct communion with Hector's face, which had the kind of fresh, animal beauty that made your eyes sting. She'd forgotten what that was like. Instant attraction. Not that she hadn't encountered beautiful men since meeting Patrick. This was New York, after all, colonized by the beautiful, the brilliant, the rich. Sometimes all three in one hazardous electromagnetic package. But falling in love with Patrick had somehow blessedly immunized her against fascination for somebody else. She could appreciate a man's gleaming charisma. She could say to herself, well, that's certainly a good-looking guy. Nice style, great sense of humor, without feeling any meaningful desire to have sex with him, even in the abstract, even in fantasy. So it was strange, and shameful, and utterly unsettling that when she tried to meet Hector's lupine gaze, she felt her skin heating up and her mind grasping for wit. Like some membrane had dissolved in her sensible, grown-up, married brain, unleashing an adolescent miasma. Wanting to say something sensible and thinking, "Your eyes are the color of cappuccino. Can I drink you?"
"My mom was a rule follower, too," Hector said. "It's okay. I get it. Nothing to be ashamed of."
"I'm not ashamed. You guys seriously fold each other's laundry?"
"Sure. I mean, when we have to, not just because. That would be weird."
"What about, well, you know," he grinned again.
"Unmentionables? If you feel that strongly, Queen Victoria, you can always take them up to your room and dry them on a chair arm. Me? I've got nothing to hide. Just tidy-whities. Pretty boring stuff."
"You do realize we're in New York City, right? A rental building? We're not even supposed to make eye contact in the hallway." Hector shrugged. He wore a fine-gauge V-neck sweater, charcoal gray, cashmere or merino, a bit shabby, exposing a triangle of white T-shirt at the neck. The sleeves were pushed halfway up his forearms. The blue jeans were likewise worn, but to an honest fade, not the awkward, fake threads of a pre-shredded pair. He had enviable olive skin, and maybe that was the key to his strange luminosity. This smooth, golden sheath of his that didn't show a single line, not even in the fluorescent basement lighting. Just a shadow of stubble on his jaw. Because, of course, he rolled out of bed like that, stretched, shook himself, probably drank a shot of wheatgrass and did 50 naked push-ups.
"Just the way we operate around here," he said. "Band of brothers. And sisters."
"But folding laundry? Really? That's... I don't know, it's so personal."
"It's just laundry. And we are kind of personal around here. Anyway, you can't just dump your buddy's clothes in a pile and leave the scene. That would be wrong."
"Why wrong?"
"Do unto others, Ella. Who wants wrinkled t-shirts?"
"Then just do your laundry some other time. After work. What's with everyone jamming up the laundry room at dawn on a Saturday? I feel like I've walked into some kind of cuckoo commune."
"It's not that bad, I swear."
"Yeah, it is. It's totally a commune. And I'll bet you're the mayor."
"I don't think communes have mayors, do they? I mean, by definition."
"You're dodging the question."
"Sorry." He hung his head a little. "Like I said, I have seniority, that's all."
"Seniority? You?" He ran a hand through his hair, which was shaggy and dark and thick, contributing hugely to Ella's overall impression of Hector as a handsome, unkempt wolfhound.
"Is it that bad? I guess I should clean up my act a little more. That's what happens when you don't spend all day working for the man."
Ella threw up her hands. "Fine. Don't tell me anything. I'll just have to figure out all the house rules on my own. Or do my laundry on Monday nights after work."
"Actually, no. You don't want to do that. Nights are bad."
"Bad? Bad how?" Across the room, the first dryer switched off and let out a series of frantic beeps. Hector jumped from the table.
"Oops, that's me."
"Should I give you a hand?"
"Nah, I've got it."
"Are you sure? I'm feeling a disturbing need to contribute somehow."
"Ah, see? Drinking the Kool-Aid already."
"Drinking something, that's for sure," Ella thought. Realized, the horror, she was staring at Hector's backside as he bent to remove the clothes from the dryer. Like a teenager. And then she remembered, like an electric shock, "Jesus, I'm married!" The way she would sometimes have nightmares, early in her marriage, in which she was in bed with some faceless man. Nobody in particular, having sex, and realized halfway through that she had a husband and she was cheating on him. And she would startle awake and stare, heart-thumping, at Patrick's sleeping shoulder and feel such a drenching, horrified guilt that she actually cried. As if she had genuinely, consciously, in real life, committed the crime of adultery. Except this wasn't a dream. Hector was real. Hector and his pert backside. His unemployed, slacker hotness stood a few yards away, had a name and a face, and now, in this altered landscape of her life, unexpected and unsought, she had no nearby husband to immunize her. No one to keep her safe from the wolfhounds of New York City. She turned swiftly for the door. "Guess I'll be going then."
"Wait. Hold on a second."
Unless he wasn't real. Unless he was an actor or something, installed here as an instance of charity, or maybe a test, or occupational therapy. She wouldn't put that kind of trick past her mother. She wouldn't put anything at all past her sister, even though Joni was supposed to be studying in Paris right now. He certainly looked like an actor. If this happened in a movie, vigorous, raven-locked guy prowls into post-breakup laundry room and purrs all the right things, you would roll your eyes and say, "Nice try." Or you would think it was some kind of porn. "I can't," she said over her shoulder.
"Please?"
Ella paused, hand on knob. "You're a big boy, don't beg."
"Not begging. Just polite, like my mama taught me. So, do you have a minute?"
"Not really. I've got a lot of unpacking to do."
"Wow. The brush off. Was it something I said?"
"No. I'm sorry."
"Don't say sorry. If I accidentally shot off some kind of sexist bullshit, just call me on it, okay? My bad."
"No, it's not bad. I just..." "I'm married," she finished in her head. "Wronged, scorned, cheated upon, humiliated, separated. All those things. But also, technically married. And I don't know if you're hitting on me or not. It's only been 5 minutes, but I think I might have been hitting on you. Was I? And if I was, is that morally wrong or just really, really stupid? Or something else? Something that would take a therapist to explain properly and at great length and expense."
"I mean, I don't want to hold you up or anything. Just tell you about a few things. Rules of the road. In case I don't see you around over the next few days and you end up bringing your laundry down here at night."
"What do you mean? Are there rats or something?"
No. Not rats. I mean, there might be rats, who knows, but probably not. No droppings or whatever."
Hector's voice had turned a little uncertain, or maybe apologetic was a better word, and the change was so interesting that Ella now swiveled to face him. In doing so, she caught a glimpse of herself in the mirror that hung inexplicably above the folding table on which Hector's problematic backside had recently been resting. The greasy hair, the flushed, bare face, the baggy t-shirt. "Jesus Christ, Ella. You fucking idiot." She never swore aloud, but her inner monologue could flame along like a Tarantino movie when she was angry enough. "What the hell were you thinking? Of course he's not hitting on you. Unless someone's paying him to do it. Unless he pities you." She smiled gently. "You know what? I'm sorry. Didn't mean to be rude. Just got a lot on my mind, that's all."
"No hard feelings. Moving stressful. Right up there with death and divorce, they say. I just wanted to say that it's not Kool-Aid."
"Sorry? What's not Kool-Aid?"
"The whole thing."
He slammed the dryer door on his load of wet laundry and straightened, turned to her, folded his arms across his lean chest. He had a loping, tensile shape to him, in keeping with the wolfhound aspect. Patrick was more muscular, gym-honed, though not quite as tall.
"The 11 Christopher thing. It's not rats, either. It's the speakeasy."
"The speakeasy? You mean like a bar?"
"Like a bar, sure."
He pulled apart his arms and pointed his thumb to the wall, the one with the table and the mirror, cinder blocks covered in gray paint.
"Right there, in the basement, the other side of that wall. Starts up at night. You can hear the music and the voices, people laughing and having a good time. Sometimes you can actually feel the walls vibrate, you know, from the dancing and all that, and sometimes other stuff."
"Wow. Really? I didn't see a storefront or an entrance or anything."
"Well, that's kind of the point with a speakeasy. You have to know it's there."
Hector fastened on her face as he said this, giving her his full, charged attention. That friendly gaze had gone narrow, more serious, and instead of pressing the necessary buttons on the dryer, he just folded his arms back across his chest and waited for her to reply. And she thought, Or, really, the thought arrived in her head unsolicited. Why, he isn't young at all, is he? His eyes? They're antiques. They were born old and tanned and heavy. Where did you come from, little old soul? Except those were Ella's mother's words, tucking her into bed, leaning in to kiss her forehead. The smell of Chanel. Where did you come from, little old soul? She realized he was expecting a reply. She wasn't sure what to say. Was she supposed to care about the bar next door? Were the residents upset? Was there some kind of petition he wanted her to sign? This was New York. If you couldn't stand the constant interruption of the city around you, the sirens splitting your ears and the bridge and tunnel crowd vomiting outside your window at 3 in the morning, you packed up and left for the suburbs pretty fast. So what was the deal? She asked. Is the noise really bad? The super didn't say anything. I mean, I'm a pretty sound sleeper. More importantly, she went on, trying for a lighter note. Will they give us a house discount? The chuckle he returned seemed a little too nervous, broke the strange earnestness between them. He turned to the dryer and pressed his thumb on one of the buttons. It was an old model. The buttons were large and stiff and stuck down when you pushed them. There was a click, a faint buzz of electric engagement, and then the drum began to turn. Bang, bang, bang.
House discount, Hector said. That's a good one. But sorry, no can do.
Bummer. What is it, some kind of secret celebrity hangout?
Nope. I mean, no one we would know. It's more of a...
The door swung open, hitting Ella in the arm, and a small, dainty girl bounded through behind an old-fashioned wicker laundry basket. Her skin was fresh and peachy, and her hair was the color of organic honey.
Oh, my God, I'm so sorry. Are you okay?
Ella rubbed her arm.
Fine. No, really. I should have looked first. I'm such a klutz.
I'm okay. Really, just leaving.
You're the new girl, right?
She put her basket on her hip and stuck out her hand.
I'm Jen, 3C.
Hi, Jen. I'm Ella. Jen turned to Hector in a whip of honey hair.
Hello, up there. Up to no good?
He spread out his hands.
You know me. Sleep well?
All right.
She ruffled his forelock.
I heard you playing.
Just for you, babe.
Me and all the others. Wait, isn't that machine done yet? Put my stuff on top like an hour ago.
My bad. Jumped ahead of you.
You what?
You snooze, you lose, right?
Jen smacked him with the wicker basket.
You creep! That is, like, so wrong. We have a thing here in this building. Where's the trust?
How?
Hector said, rubbing his shoulder.
All right. Mea culpa. Won't happen again.
Ella spoke up. Actually, he's covering for me. It was my laundry.
Your laundry?
But I put her up to it,
Hector said. Jen shook her head in sorrow.
I just don't know what to say. This is so disappointing.
I was just trying to be nice.
Look, said Ella, I'm sorry about the laundry. I owe you one, okay?
Oh, I'm not mad at you. It's this one.
Jen jerked her thumb at Hector.
Watch out. He's notorious. Definitely can't be trusted with cute new tenants.
Ella reached for the door handle. Her stomach hurt, like she'd just taken a fist.
Yeah, I'll just be going now. Nice to meet you both.
Ella, wait.
But Ella pretended not to hear him. Let the door close on notorious Hector and dainty Jen and the 4 busy washing machines and 2 busy dryers. the table where you folded your neighbor's clothes, and the wall separating you from some kind of weird, exclusive underground bar with no signage outside. The mirror that said you were nobody's cute new tenant. Just the kind of woman who couldn't keep her husband safe in his own bed. Saturday nights were the worst. You could keep yourself busy unpacking all day, and Ella did, until the last box was empty and broken down for recycling, until the last book was on the shelf and the last spoon in the drawer, and only the few pictures needed hanging. But once you opened the shrunken fridge and began to contemplate your few alluring options for dinner, you realized how much you took for granted in marriage. Not that Ella hadn't before found herself alone on a Saturday night. Sometimes Patrick was overseas, some Europe junket or else paying calls on Asia. And sometimes he had client dinners, sometimes out with the boys. Anyway, that was the story, which she'd never doubted until now. But these absences were infrequent enough that she actually, if she was honest with herself, relished the freedom. She might have had dinner with Joni, or at least until Joni left for Paris, or her aunt and uncle, whom she adored, or even gone down to Washington to stay with her parents. For the most part, though, she hung out with Patrick. Dinner, movie, TV, sex. Usually sex. She took pride in keeping the electricity in her marriage. Her husband would never have to saw on the old chestnut that he wasn't getting any at home now that Ella had a ring on her finger. Oh, no. She almost always said yes, even when she was tired or busy with work. Ella's father looked eternally on her mother like she was Ginger and Marianne all rolled in one. Ella had caught them at it more than once. So embarrassing. And that was her model. That was the marriage she wanted to have. The kind everybody envied. She wanted the radiant, satisfied skin her mother had. The adoring gaze that followed her mother around the house. Tonight, however, and for all the Saturday nights stretching into the imaginable future, there would be no sex. No Cabernet and steak frites at the bistro around the corner. No Twilight movie theater, laughing together at the same jokes, hands bumping in the popcorn. Just this half-empty fridge, this leftover baked ziti from the pizza place next to the subway stop. This TV set, these books, this studio apartment, the sprawling, affluent contents of her life compacted back into a single room as if the past 6 years had never really occurred, as if they were just some play she had watched, some theme park she had visited, and now she was back in her rightful life. This clock ticking steadily into bedtime. She ate the ziti and washed the dishes. She picked up a book she was supposed to read last year for that book club she went to for a while and poured herself a glass of wine. And another. Went to bed at 11 and stared at the dark ceiling. Somewhere in the building, somebody was playing a jazz CD. Solo trumpet. Wynton Marsalis or something. Long and lonely and melancholy, rolling up and down the scale like it was reaching for something that didn't exist. And then she remembered. She'd left her laundry downstairs. The building was irredeemably old-fashioned, even though the paint was fresh and the staircase sturdy, maybe because it seemed to have largely escaped any horrifying post-war renovations, or worse, ersatz period details added back later. When she'd inspected the place last week, Ella had liked that. She wanted something different from the sleek Soho loft she had just escaped, which they had bought 2 years ago when Patrick got promoted to managing director and came home with his first really serious bonus. And whatever your preference for traditional design or new, you certainly couldn't detect the handprints of some visionary, wall-demolishing architect on this place. She loved all the authentic, handmade moldings and the creaky floorboards, the quirky layout, and the low-voltage lighting. Of course, that was during the afternoon, when the winter sun had flooded softly through the old windows and turned the air gentle. Now, at 9 o'clock on a Saturday night, Ella felt she was creeping downstairs through some kind of gothic novel. Or maybe that was the wine in the book. In Cold Blood. Not the best choice for your lonely Saturday night. And the nocturnal melancholy of discovering your husband was having sex with other women. Or possibly the ziti, which sat unsteadily in Ella's stomach, like it knew it wasn't wanted. And there was something else. Something she'd noticed on her first visit. Something that had made her turn to the super and pull out her checkbook and say, "I'll take it." Something vibrant in the air. Something that lived inside the walls. Her parents' house had it. Her first apartment had it. Her junior year dorm had it. The Soho loft, gutted and cleared out and renovated to the studs from a derelict warehouse, everything old replaced by everything new, had not. Until now, turning the last corner of the stairwell, she hadn't realized just how dead that apartment was. How she'd missed the company. So maybe it wasn't fear that she felt, reaching for the laundry room door. Maybe it wasn't dread of the unknown, or of Hector's strange warning about rats and noise from the bar and vibrating walls. Maybe it was anticipation. She opened the door.
Act 1. We meet, and it's a doozy. New York City, 1924. 1. There's this joint on Christopher Street, a joint I'd know like the beat of my own heart, if I happen to have one. They used to call it the Christopher Club, and now it's just Christopher's. When you enter through a door in the basement of the grocery next door, you first smell the rotten vegetables and the cat piss. But never worry. All that stink clears up when the cigarettes and the liquor engulf you. And the music. The best jazz south of 96th Street. The bass player's a good friend of mine. Bruno. I don't know his last name. Nobody does. We don't deal in surnames unless absolutely necessary. Now, I don't inhabit the place every evening. I'm a working girl, you know, and I need my beauty sleep. But as I happen to live on the other side of said grocery, in a tiny room at the back of the fourth floor, I like to drop in from time to time, friendly-like, for a drink and a dance and a smoke and a gossip. As I'm doing now. Right there at the corner table. No, the other corner, next to the music. Wearing a black dress and crimson lips and a head of strawberry hair. The hair's natural, the lips aren't. And that darling rosy-scrubbed black and white fellow I'm flirting with, the one who's taken the trouble to dress like a gentleman, that's Billy Marshall, my latest, a Princeton boy. You know the type. He's reading me this poem he's written in my honor. A real sweetie pie, my Billy boy. But I'm afraid I'm not listening. A man's just walked through the door like a prize fighter looking for a prize. The kind of fella who demands your immediate attention. Square shoulders, bony jaw, plain gray suit, sharp felt hat. You know the type. The thing is, you don't see him around a joint like this. A joint in the village. Long wooden bar and no chandelier. Starving artists and starving artists' models. Queers and poets. Jews and Negroes. Swank babies like Billy Boy descending southward in search of local color. We haven't seen a gray suit around here since that stockbroker last year who lost his way back to the IRT station from a Bedford station brothel on the down low, if you know what I mean.
Where he got the password, God knows. Anyway, this particular suit is cold sober. Overcoat over his arm. Nose as monochrome as the rest of him. Wouldn't know a good time if it kissed him on the kisser and unbuttoned his starched white shirt. Right away, I give the eyebrows to the owner, the man behind the bar. We call him Christopher. Nobody knows his real name. And he gives the eyebrows right back, only more in the nature of a question mark. I flick the gaze back to the newcomer. Christopher makes this tiny nod and strolls down the bar, directly in the fellow's line of sight, and braces two hands on the edge of the counter, like the knots of a terribly thick rope.
"Darling," says Billy,
"are you listening?" "Of course I'm listening, sweetie. Go on." By now, the stranger has reached the bar, along a line right down the center of Christopher's wingspan. He sets one foot on the rail and one elbow on the counter, and he asks for something. I can't hear what. Over the rim of his shoulder, Christopher's eyebrows glide upward.
"You don't like it."
"I adore it. I think it's awfully clever. And those rhymes, why, you could have Bruno here set it to music." "It's a sonnet, Jin. An English sonnet. Not a music hall song." "You can make a lot of bread from a music hall song." "Who cares about money?" He seizes my hand on the table. "I care about you, darling. I care about taking you away from all this." "And what if I like all this just fine? It sure beats the place I grew up in. Why, a joint like this is paradise compared to back home." "You're too fine and good to be sitting here in this lousy dump. You deserve a better life out in the country, where you don't have to lift a finger. Where you don't have to spend 8 hours a day in slavery to some lecherous banker. Where you don't have to think about anything so crass as..." "You know something, Billy boy? I generally find that people who say they don't care about money are the exact same people who've never had to earn any." "You're right. You're quite right." "And that's what I want for..." "Cherub," I say kindly, returning his hand. "Will you excuse me a moment? It seems my company is required at the bar." 2. "Now, before you go forming any ill opinions of me, let me assure you, I've never taken a cold dime from Billy the Kid. A drink or two, maybe, but no kale. I don't allow any gentleman to pay for the privilege of my company. I've seen too many girls get into hot water that way. And anyway, Billy's such a dear fellow. We met several weeks ago at some uptown party or another. I think Julie Schuyler introduced us. She's a friend of mine, if you can call it that. And he looked at me, and I looked at him, and he had this lovely, sheepish, clean-eared handsomeness, this scrub jaw and pink cheek and full lower lip, this brown eye just waiting for a match to set it smoldering, lean, straight shoulders and new skin, his shirt front as wide and flat as pure marble, his head tilted forward, and his mouth cracked open, his pink tongue fumbling for a greeting. I said, 'Hello there, I'm Jin,' and he said, 'I'm Billy.' And I said, 'Pleased to meet you, Billy the Kid,' emphasis on the pleased, and he just blushed into his blonde curling hair, and I fell in love. I took his hand, and we danced a bit, and then we went out into the cold Manhattan morning, and kissed right there on the corner of Fifth Avenue and 61st Street, while the frozen branches of Central Park scratched against the nearby wind. And his lips were exactly as soft and warm as I feared. Later, he asked me if my name was really Jin, and I said no. It was Geneva. But people called me Ginger because of my hair, and Ginger became Jin." His face showed relief. I guess he was afraid I might be a drunk. 3. Unlike Billy, that tall, slender sapling full of promise, the stranger at the bar is a live oak, limbs thick, neck like a trunk, ears planted on each side of his head. His shorn golden brown hair puts me in mind of a pelt. Next to his elbow, atop the plain black overcoat, his hat contains the perfect curves of a Fifth Avenue haberdashery, the kind that charges you a mint and sends you out a gentleman. Next to his other elbow sits a glass of sweet milk, straight up.
Evening, Jin. Christopher nods to the stranger. Fellow was asking for you.
I point to the milk. Make it two, will you? Christopher turns away and I hold out my hand. Ginger, Kelly, I couldn't help admiring your shoulders. Do you swing from trees?
Not since I was 10.
Voice like a bass drum beaten by a knotted rope. Crush coconuts between your bare palms?
That depends on what you mean by coconuts.
He takes my hand.
Oliver Anson.
What a civilized-sounding name. Irish?
English.
My mistake. The milk lands on the counter. Christopher adds a look that asks whether I require any assistance, and I return a look that says, keep an eye on Billy for me, will you? I lift my glass. Cheers.
Cheers.
Clink. Drink. The band starts a new piece, drawling, full of blues. Bruno's bass thrums up and down. The milk is ice cold and creamy and pure on the tongue, the taste of childhood. And as I study Anson's face over the rim of the glass, I consider the contrast between his genteel clothes and his rocky, tanned face. His eyes, so dark a blue, they are almost without color at all. I can usually take down the measure of a man at first glance. It's a talent of mine, the way some folks can whip up a souffle or paint someone's face. But this one isn't adding up. A cop doesn't have the dough to dress like that. A gangster doesn't have the taste. Anyway, he's young. Not as young as Billy, but younger than I thought. The few lines on his face are new and kind of faint, as if sketched by a needle. I set down the milk. Tell me something, Mr. Anson. Just how do you come to know my name and whereabouts?
Does it matter?
It might. A girl making her way in the big city can't be too careful.
I quite agree.
And you can't trust a living soul I've found. Always some do-gooder skulking around, you know. The vice patrol, looking to catch a girl out on the town for the crime of having a good time.
You think I'm some kind of bull?
Now, what kind of question is that? We're just standing here, drinking our milk like good little boys and girls. Nothing wrong with that.
He glances at Billy and back again. Is he yours?
Maybe he is, and maybe he isn't. I don't believe that's any of your business.
I think he's about to make it my business.
So Billy storms up, flushed to the temples, neck pink against his white collar, and inserts himself between me and Anson, demands to know what the devil he thinks he's doing. They're the exact same height, maybe 6 feet and a hair of the dog, but I believe Billy weighs about half as much. Anson replies to this perfectly legitimate question with the polite tolerance you might lay on a stale donut, says something about having a private word with me.
Well, you can't have a private word with her.
Can't I?
No, Miss Kelly has nothing to do with you, nothing at all. She's here with me. Do you understand? Minding our own business.
I see.
Mr. Anson finishes his milk, lays a dollar bill on the counter, collects his hat and his overcoat, nods to me in such a way that you could almost call it a bow.
A pleasure. Miss Kelly.
Oh, man, Mr. Anson. He walks away, leaving that whole dollar bill unchanged on the counter, straight up the steps and out the door. And Billy turns to me, all bright and crackly with triumph, the dear young thing.
Well, I sure as hell showed him, didn't I?
4. The powder room at the back of Christopher's isn't much to speak of, and I've seen a crapper or two in my time. I mean, it's a basement of a basement. What are you gonna do? There's about enough room to swing a cat, if you're the kind of damned brute who swings cats, and your cat belongs to a pygmy trap. The tiles are black and white, the mirror's chipped, the sink bears the stains of 1,000 furtive cigarettes. The toilet's liable to flush you down hole if you're not careful. In the corner, there's a narrow ventilation shaft. I use the term loosely, leading to the stinking back garden of the next-door grocery. And I am presently contemplating said shaft as a means of possible escape. Not from poor Billy, whose bravery in the face of Tarzan has just about melted down the sides of that place in my chest where the heart's supposed to lie.